So about this time of session, things start to get quiet. Not so much really to be said. But at the same time, we have this opportunity to talk together. I was talking yesterday about silence and this kind of settling down, that internal silence, and it led to two things I think of. One is maybe a little more superficial, is familiarizing yourself with this way of being. That's part of what we're doing. It's not like a method or anything, but again, everything gets pared down, and so you can see those last grasping points in yourself. And it really has nothing to do with anybody else in that sense, that these are the things for you to attend to, the hooks, the Coben called it grinding and polishing. Sangha practice. Grinding and polishing. And to look at other people as a reflection of your actions, I guess you could say. And at the same time, not to be affected by their response or their coming at you, because that's their thing to deal with. So there's observing and not responding, and taking responsibility for yourself. And something else that comes up for me in these, particularly in these long sits, is the feeling of gratitude towards all of you, to my teacher and other teachers who directly we contacted and had a heart-to-heart, mind-to-mind connection, and to all the ancestors who carried this way forward. Sometimes I feel them sitting in the circle just outside this one. To some degree, I'm speaking of like the vows that we make or the precept ceremony, partly because of John, partly because of your question also yesterday. And the thing for me about those vows, I ran into them somewhat at a young age, so I didn't really question it, and just Coben said, okay, here we go. I do this. But it was with a deep connection to this sitting practice and in the context of this, and so it all made perfect sense. So somewhat, from the outside, it looks a little strange. People bowing and clasping their hands, chanting and things. But on the other hand, if you look backwards, it's it's 2,500 years or more, excuse me, of people doing this. And we want to change, bring it into daily contemporary life, which we have because our lifestyle is different, so we practice differently. But some of these essential pieces are still enacted, I think, to honor and respect the wisdom that we've discovered and that's been transmitted breath by breath to this current point. And also those vows, you know, on the one hand you feel them and intuit that they're what you're hearing and accepting is correct. And on the other hand, you grapple with it, somewhat question it, and refine them in that way. And also, taking vows like that, it allows you to relax. Okay, that part's done. I accepted it. And the other part of our conversation so far is, I think the most intriguing is this backward step, this turning the light around. I looked into it a little more, kind of hard, but seems to some degree that it's perception of this light is still some slight separation, and turning it around, one phrase said, no. Nothing observed and no one observing it. So this is the deep point of Zazen. But I have a question for all of you. What is your reason for sitting? It's interesting too that we gather and for whatever reason, some people say, you know, you gather as a sangha is what I'm getting at. And in this case, or for many of us in the early days, it was around COVID, and yet we didn't choose the other people to come. It was everybody came to Koven, and whoever was there was who you practiced with. And same thing's true here. You know, I didn't like call all of you up and say, "Hey, Joe's coming. You should come." You know, but the reason I bring it up, it's great to have you all. It's like this karmic thing that, you know, why did we come together? My wife and Koven used to dream together a few times. Wake up in the morning, "Did you dream?" Yes, I was there. Koven lived in that. That stream was certainly in his awareness. And she said she was the Tenzo and he was the abbot of some monastery. And I was the... I said, "What was I?" Sweeping the floors. But there's a sense of that, like I said, that vow of awakening, you know, we've... returning to this way. And I think it's worth looking at that. If you have doubt, then you should resolve it. But if you feel, not necessarily like with everybody, but if you feel that kind of connection, then it's worth embracing. And by the way, John, when before Koven died, I had many things to do at Hokoji, and some of them Koven was, you know, pushing me to do. Jeez, at the time of talking, he'd say, "Say something, say something." And I was very shy, too shy to talk. I can't do that. But when he died, "Oh my God," I said, "I have to do everything he asked me to do." Because there's such intimacy and love, I guess you could say, and that passing of presence. And so thank you for doing what you're doing Saturday. Leading up to it, all of you, actually. Like this chant, and like when I first arrived, I said it's a rare opportunity, a unique opportunity, and I really believe that. And with whatever personality differences, or somebody rubs you the wrong way or something, you don't get hung up on that. You honor them. And you can work on whatever bothers you. But you know, the way of moving through the temple grounds when in silence, when you meet and you just stop and bow and keep going. It's very, very deep practice, actually. Don't have to engage in any dialogue, or you just acknowledge each other's presence and thank them for their effort. And if you have some doubt about what we're doing, I recommend that you suspend your disbelief. Joe said it the other day, that stick with the form and maybe it will invert. so you don't judge it or adjust it. And it becomes a very profound way of being. So. Anybody?
Again, the term vows, you know, in our culture, I think the closest thing we can come to that is the marriage altar. Mm. I don't usually hear it in the common parlance of everyday language. It's a kind of, are you in the court and you swear to tell the truth? That's kind of a vow. But I'm curious to know, because this is coming down from you know, Asia, we tend to color a lot of our experiences here from our cultural heritage.
Yeah.
And I've heard discussions about, you know, what are the precepts? Are these vows? Are these commandments? You know, Judeo-Christian, it's not. I don't think it is. But so if you could kind of expand on what perhaps Koban would say, or what, coming from the Soto Zen background, what does the, you know, the vow, what do we mean by that?
Well, specific to vow, I would say that not falling back into delusion. You vow to continue your effort to not fall back into delusion. Wake up, don't fall asleep. Precepts are somewhere, I don't know if it's in that translation that Koban did of Bodhidharma's in the title, but it's one mind precept, something like that. One precept, not 10, not 16. You wake up to your original nature, not something construed in your mind, and the radiance of that is the one precept. The light of that hitting a prism goes out, and you have all the multitude of pieces, the precepts, the paramitas, and so on, but it's all from one source. And probably already said it. It, all of those things are active now. So you don't have to conjure them up. You just have to open up. And they can also be used as reminders. I mean, it's, you can work your way back to some degree, but one mind precept. And it is somewhat like a marriage in the sense of it's a commitment. Commitment to what? You have to figure out, but how you're going to enact that commitment, just like every marriage is different. In fact, I was ordained as a priest, and then a year or two later got married, and Colvin said, "Where are your okesa to your wedding?" Married in my okesa. My wife was at the first ceremony, so she knew what she was getting into.
You were talking about how Joe said something about the practice inverting. And I have, in my ignorance, no clue what that means.
Yeah.
So if you could say it another way or something.
Should ask Joe to explain it. If you like.
That's kind of a wide-ranging idea. Deal with me once in a while. There will be a form or something in life I don't like, and or it's not going the way I want it to, or maybe I want life to take on my form, and it tends not to. And but once in a while, if I keep going with it, sometimes an answer will open up. What I don't like becomes something I like. Once in a while, I'll see that actually, that now I've completely done it in one sense, that the opposite makes sense at times. And it kind of reveals that the opposite is also true, and that both work. And it's a question of time. Like sometimes my form, sometimes another form. There's a lot to that. It was kind of a general wide ranging idea that maybe people could think about. Ian, can you clarify that anymore? I hope to know more about that when I reach a few more years.
Well, we. At Hokoji, different teachers would come and make subtle adjustments to how we were doing things, and some arguments ensued. Not big arguments, just differences. And I came to feel that there was no one right way to do it. But it was just what we agreed on to do. So that there's, in terms of these forms, so that that there's flow during the sesshin, that there isn't, there's always some bumping and grinding, but clanking, if you will, but to get through that and figure out how to make it smooth, just like meeting people and bowing, that same acknowledgement of whatever it is you're doing, working together or serving, eating. So to not get too hung up on whether it's right or wrong is my sense. And we've all, many of us have practiced a certain way. I know Peter and Jerry and Cliff and I anyway have. John and Steve, you know, and you, we practiced with Colvin, and we had this certain way of doing things, so we would just get up and do it, and it would flow. But in New Mexico, which is where I spent the last, 25 plus years, the Colvin would, when things got too comfortable, he'd change something. Just a little bit, so then we weren't hung up on it, you know. Different than inverting. But.
I think that inverting concept is very big and permeates Zen practice. Sometimes it's, you can't tell the difference between form and formlessness. or between shadow and light, and things, or between what's substantial and insubstantial. And it seems that it doesn't really matter a lot of times, that you can work with the insubstantial at least as effectively as what you'd always thought was the real.
Sure.
And so allowing yourself to switch back and forth is really, I think, part of the practice, and our everyday forms can be part of that discipline.
Well, it came from the statement, there was a lot that happened that day, but this statement came at lunch. I know it's like come from two lineages, and as we were eating, where I come from, we gosh, oh, for seconds, and here there's the stakes placed on the bowl. And so I noticed that I was gosh-owing and doing it wrong, and there were other people copying me, and the food was going right by them. And so it occurred to me that the correct form in that situation is to, you know, I saw food going past hungry people. And the correct form was whichever way they were fed, that they were sustained. So it didn't matter if the chopsticks were on the bowl or the gosho, but could we see how they care for each other?
But I think also what Steve is speaking to one thing is it goes to the essence, like what you're saying about the important thing is that hungry people get fed, but to the essence of what we're doing, not being hung up on the form of it. And that flexibility also applies to everyday life when you leave here and you carry the essence of this with you. And to be able to be flexible in different circumstances, maintaining this core level of whatever it is you're discovering, uncovering.